the unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect truth, is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I had it in mind to give a talk on a very difficult subject this morning and decided not to because, frankly, I just simply don't have the confidence to tackle it right now. So we're going to do something that's kind of like odds and ends. I'd like to talk about change and not the change that's happening in the sense of daylight turning into night or time going by, but the kind of change that we intend to have happen because we enter the hall and practice meditation. The kind of change that moves towards understanding and peace of mind. And we'll probably talk a little bit about the precepts and a few other odds and ends as well as they relate to that. I must be nervous. I never drink the water. A few years ago, Rev. Master Kodo mentioned to me, it was shortly after a Dharma talk I'd given, that Dharma talk doesn't add up to very much unless it helps people change a little. You know, a Dharma talk just as a description of the Dharma or a description of doctrine, or as an exhortation of some kind, or whatever. If it stops at that, it stops short of a useful intention. The useful intention for all practice, and for Dharma talks, for conversation, for sanzen, for anything you do, is the progressive change of ourselves towards understanding. It's why we come here. Coming here to feel good doesn't count, although feeling good can be part of change. Going to church because your mother tells you to never paid good dividends, did it? Okay? The authority has to come from within. The prompting, the guidance, the inclination, they come from within us, they don't come from without. And it's responding to that inner prompting that works. When we first come, let's backpedal a second. Reverend Master Jiu wrote a book that she called Zen is Eternal Life. It went through a couple of titles, actually. It was originally Selling Water by the River. It's, I'm sure, on the shelves up in the library. In that, she has a couple of essays at the beginning describing the heart of Kanzaon, the heart of Samadabhadra, and of Manjusri. And she talks about the need for change, that we have to change the way we go about things rather completely, but not necessarily all at once, but nevertheless, profoundly, we need to enact change in our lives. Now, one of the first ways in which this change takes place is outward. The way we conduct ourselves in visible form, how we spend our time, perhaps becoming vegetarian, perhaps eliminate the perhaps, attempting as best we can to live a kindly and gentle life, diminishing the violence, diminishing the ill effects, keeping the precepts as best we can, although treating the precepts as a a code of rules does not bode well for the future. Codes of rules seldom go very far. But the intention to change one's destructive life patterns is a necessary part of the outward activity of learning to meditate. Also, coming to the temple, for monks living in the temple, conducting meditation in the place where you live. Now, for monks, of course, that's in the meditation hall next door. But for everybody who has a home, conduct meditation and practice in your home. Wisdom begins in the home, begins within you, which is your home. And if you practice it in your own, in the privacy of your own homes, it produces results that are visible. Same's true with any form of education. When the kids are sent to school to learn their reading, writing, and arithmetic, they don't learn them very well in school unless there's backup at home. Everybody, all the teachers at least, know this. Relatively few parents do. You know, you've got to give kids support at home to get a result. For anybody to gain a taste for reading or for counting or for whatever, these things have to happen at home, and the same is true with meditation. It happens at the home. Okay, very important. These are the outward changes we make in our lives when we attempt to become Buddhists. Or if we make even an attempt to clean up our lives without necessarily formally becoming Buddhists, this is the sort of thing we undertake to do. Then there's the change on the inside, which is what everybody wants, but nobody knows how to make it happen. To some extent, it is true to say that changing our lives on the outside, you know, the way we do things, like I said before, helps to change us on the inside. If this were not true, we would have much less reason to give credibility to those changes on the outside. It does help, but we don't know how. Nobody knows how. I used to ask Reverend Master Eck, I asked him a number of times actually, how does this work? Because I could see it working, but I couldn't see how. And I asked him, he never gave me an answer. He just evaded it. He walked right around it, like the question wasn't there. And if, you know, I actually cottoned onto it right from the beginning, that he was not going to answer that question. There isn't a how. It's not just a matter of us not knowing the how. In a sense, there isn't a method. There's nothing you can do that will change you on the inside directly. You know, you can't pick a piece of your insides and remodel it. You can't do that. You can change your outward life, but the connection to what's inside you is not in your hands or mine. And yet, we'll come back to the how in a moment or two. It's very important that this change takes place, isn't it? Otherwise, happiness will not appear. Peace will remain a fantasy. Understanding and wisdom will become things that somebody else has. Maybe. Reverend Master Jiyu used to talk about the harmonization of body and mind as a fair description of what's happening when you undertake spiritual training. Harmonization of body and mind. It doesn't mean the pacification of body and mind or the making of it into something that feels good. It isn't a process whereby our minds lose their exposure to disturbance, or where our bodies cease to be sick. That is not offered, except in certain ways. But, well, that's not part of today's talk. By and large, those things are not necessarily on the cards at all. Harmonization of body and mind is the way in which your life on the outside is part of the life on the inside, and vice versa. So that there is perfect continuity between the two, and there is no sense of doing something that's meaningless. Now, a lot of people talk about their lives before they come here as pointless, meaningless, useless, whatever, okay? Or adjectives of varying degrees of intensity. Some form of dissatisfaction with one's circumstances and one's life pretty much always occurs before anybody comes through that door. Doesn't have to be a disaster. It can be nothing more than a whisper in your internal ear that all is not well. A sense of restlessness, of hunger, of something. You know, it can be many, many levels of discomfort can be involved. And this, of course, brings us to training. But it is more than just an invitation to training. It's a symptom of the trouble. I can remember when I was in my last couple of years before finally deciding I had to come to a place like this, sensing a growing feeling like when I touched something, I didn't touch it. Like when I saw things, they were not kind of there. Things that were supposed to be, no, the things that I could remember were tangible and pleasant and fulfilling when I was a kid, weren't anymore. Food lost its taste. I used to do a lot of skin diving in the ocean. Around New Zealand, it's real pretty. Okay, it's not tropical, but it's close. I could see it almost month by month becoming plainer and more monochrome as time went by. Because everything was retreating away from me. I could go jump in the water and look at fish that were gorgeous the year before, and now I didn't have an adjective for it anymore. It was just dull. It wasn't a matter of growing out of it. It was a matter of failing. There was a disconnection happening. And when this accelerated, one particular crisis arose, which had nothing to do with skin diving, and I wound up here, where I fairly soon began to discover that this is a spiritual sickness, and it can be cured through patience and through meditation, through looking at a wall, through ceasing to try to find pretty things to look at. If you don't try so hard, it happens much better. And you become friendly with the world, and the world becomes friendly with you much more easily. However, that sounds like a pretty pat explanation, the sort of thing a therapist would give you. It's not adequate when it comes to trying to describe the harmonization of body and mind, which goes infinitely deeper than that. Kazan mentions, actually maybe I'll read it now. It's a passage in, you know, we recently did a Denkaroku retreat here that Rupa Master Mayan led, so I wound up reading the Denkaroku, or parts of it again, which I hadn't read for years. And it was nice to run into a few passages that I was surprised by and others that I kind of remembered from the past but hadn't remembered clearly. He's talking in this little piece in the chapter on Kaya Shyata. He's talking about how meditation works. He's not explaining it. He's just describing the situation. He says, you cannot comprehend this clear and unequivocal original nature by working your flesh off or discern it by means of physical movement or stillness. This state cannot be grasped by body or mind. It cannot be understood by movement or stillness. It can be found, first of all, by looking into your mind and probing deeply into yourself, and then by living fully at peace within your own still heart and by realizing the truth for yourself. If it is not clear to you in this way, you will be carrying your body and mind about futilely, as if bearing a heavy load on your shoulders 24 hours a day. Neither body nor mind will ultimately grow tranquil. You see, he doesn't describe how to achieve harmonization of body and mind, but he does stipulate its necessity if you're going to survive your life. Consider the precepts. One of the things that you notice most of all about introductory retreats, but you also notice it throughout the first 10 or 20 years of the life of meditation, people ask questions, we ask questions, about why it must be so. How can we stop killing? Why is it necessary to put a curb of some kind on sexuality? Why is it necessary to put a curb on intoxication? How can one refrain from anger? What does the last precept about the slandering of the triple treasure mean anyway? People ask so many questions about the precepts and about training, but you begin to get the feeling that they don't necessarily want an answer. What they want is an explanation of why it must be so. Why are we saddled with these damn precepts? Why is life set up so that we need so many rules? Why did God make it this way? You know, people have queried the Old Testament, for instance, for several thousand years. Some people think justifiably, but nevertheless, it's querying, trying to see a reason why these rules must exist. When you do what Reverend Master Jiu advised, which was to swallow the precepts whole without too many queries and to allow them to become your blood and bones, which can be done just through meditation and patience and kind of easing off on the questions, you begin to find this in yourself, that you have a fight going on with the precepts. You don't like them. You don't like that they have to be there. Reverend Master described a piece of the old monkey film. Anyone seen the monkey film? Some of you must have. Anyway, it's a cartoon version, made in Japan, I think, of an old Buddhist story. And there's one piece in it that portrays the protagonist as this fellow monkey, who is a monkey, incidentally, when his first encounters the precepts, they are bound around the brow of his head tightly so that it hurts slightly. And he doesn't like it. Now he makes, because he trains, he makes his peace with it. And actually in the end, that bond is removed. It ceases to be a tight thing around his temples. But at the beginning, that's exactly what it feels like. Her master, in her commentary on the monkey movie, talks about this. Now, when you first meet the precepts, it is not comfortable. Why is it not comfortable? Why is it that we even have a problem with something as seemingly straightforward as a precept against killing? It still remains a question. And Rinpoche Master Jiu used to have to answer that question to her community again and again and again. And she would talk about things like the Second World War and pacifism and how she wasn't a pacifist and had to explain why. And how her experience had demonstrated certain things about war that were what we didn't want to hear. It was trouble, always trouble, with every precept in the list. But when they do begin to become your blood and bones, when you discover that they always were anyway, that well, this is nothing new, that all you were doing was realizing the way things have always been, the sense of those precepts being distant from you, as being something on the outside, begins to cease. You don't have a sense of rules anymore, or of something binding around your temples, or of something even being a rule to which you should conform. Instead, it's something inner as well as outer. And bingo, you've actually begun to harmonize body and mind. The thing on the outside begins to harmonize with the thing on the inside, and nobody knows how. It seems that meditation helps with the how. It won't show us the how. It won't say, oh, this is how it works, all you do is so and so. It isn't quite like that. But it gives you the how. Like a road to walk on, but you don't necessarily know where it's going or who made it or what it's called. But there is a road there. And meditation, let's face it, it is a mystery to everybody. You sit down and you face a wall. What a peculiar thing to do. We let go of our thoughts. Instead of trying to use them to clarify something, we let go of them. We let go of our feelings. Instead of hanging on to them as the precious little things that they are, we let go of them. Even the nice ones. The feelings that we like the feel of, let them go. It's so difficult to explain. So there you are sitting in front of a bunch of introductory retreatants and you explain how to do meditation. And they say, why? Well, what does a monk expect legitimately? You've got to expect that why question. Because from the viewpoint of acquisition, letting go of things makes no sense. It's like leaving your wallet deliberately behind at the drugstore. Makes no sense, does it? And yet, with meditation, this is what works. You leave your wallet behind. And at the beginning of a meditation period, I still feel uncomfortable for the first minute or so. Very uncomfortable. Sometimes when I'm coming to meditation, I'm actually afraid. Because I don't know how to do this. But you sit there for a few minutes and something knows how to do it and starts to do it. And there you are. Oh, that's okay. Oh, yeah, I know you. And it's all right. But at the beginning, does anybody else have this? Yeah, right. A few courageous hands. You know, it's sometimes you can blunder through 45 minutes wondering where the hell it all went. Apart from going down some kind of dark, abysmal sewer full of thoughts. And there you are. And still it works. But we don't know how. Harmonization of body and mind was, to me, a brand new expression. I'd never heard it and never read it when Reverend Master G.U. first began to use it back in 76. I don't know where she got it from. Hang on, I'm supposed to know where she got it from, but I've forgotten. But anyway, there we are. It was new to me at the time. And at the time then, I still couldn't make much sense of it. But as the years went by, I began to realize that this is what we do. The harmonization of our bodily activities with our inward whatever it is. Because there's something in there. Okay? Of course, it's everywhere else too. And the harmonization of the inward with the outward is what we do. And it's very difficult. Because we don't believe it's possible. And half the time we don't believe it's necessary. But we finally get cornered into the necessity and then we discover the possible. And then of course the possible disappears again. And you're back, you think, well you started. But you keep at it. And then you begin to find that actually another of Reverend Master Jiu's favorite expressions gets fulfilled. The going in and out. You see, it's on the stupa out there. Going in and out, always becoming Buddha. Between failure and success, we go to and fro. Between disturbance and the peace that transcends disturbance, we go to and fro. It's okay. This is how failure and success harmonize with each other and become something that they originally are, and we don't have words for it. We would not call enlightenment enlightenment when we see it. It's the word's ridiculous. And success is even worse. It's an appalling word when applied to spirituality. And yet, you know, Reverend Master used to use it. She used to say, you know, helping each other to become a success in our own ways, in our spiritual lives, to become a success. So the word's usable, but it doesn't stop it from being a bit disturbing. So long as harmonization is imperfect, and it seems that it will always be so to some extent, although I would query that also, but that's a talk for another day. So long as harmonization is incomplete, then we remain bound to some extent to the problem of being congenital liars. Denying harmonization, not fulfilling it in detail, is lying, and it breaks that precept. Which is why Kazan said, you've got to stop worrying. about truth and lie. Dogen said the same thing in his introduction to the precepts. Stop fretting about it. There are lies in your life. The likelihood that they will go away completely is pretty much zero. You can find that one within you for whom lies do not exist, whose child you are. But you cannot claim for yourself the characteristics of God. Which doesn't stop God from being inside you, but you can't claim his characteristics. Although that he sheds them upon you all the time. And we share in them, but they don't belong to us. So, lying is a thing we have to make our peace with. And it's actually, when it all comes down to it, not that hard. It feels eerie and unstable, like walking through dirty water at the beginning. It's not that you get used to dirt. It's not quite that bad. It's that you make your peace with the presence of it. And that takes you beyond all the whole business of dirt and clean. You don't have to worry about purity anymore either. Purity is a characteristic of Buddha nature. And it is given to us. That doesn't mean belongs to us. It isn't a characteristic we can claim or even earn. It's not that way. Killing. I'm going through the precepts. Tricky business, killing. We try not to because it is so easy to do in a trivial, exploitative kind of way. I ran into a fellow just a month or two ago who saw a carpenter ant climbing up the door, up the wall of the Phagan Hermitage. I was standing right beside him. He just thumped it like that for the best of possible reasons. He didn't want the carpenter ant getting into the woodwork of the house. But I kind of hiccuped, didn't say anything. He did the best he could. It wasn't necessarily killing. A way in which you can make peace with the precept of killing, against killing, comes again through harmonizing yourself with death, your own death and everybody else's, including the carpenter ants. You don't have to go so far as to deny that death exists, but you can make your peace with it. You make your peace with it, you begin to see not merely that the trail goes on beyond death, but that in a way, nothing happens. Nothing at all. You don't see a great big light at the end of the tunnel necessarily at all. Unless, of course, you're very fond of the tunnel. Then you'll have a tunnel. Try letting go of the tunnel. You don't need a tunnel any more than you need a light. Again, Kazan says that a number of times. He doesn't talk about the tunnel. This light at the end of the tunnel stuff, I think, was not necessarily part of his culture, the way he is about us. But he does talk about light as being the characteristic of Buddha nature, and that we, when we find Buddha nature, discover that light is not necessary. Billy Blake wrote a wonderful little patch in a poem one time. How did it go? I wonder if I can remember. God appears and God is light to those poor souls who dwell in night. But does a human form display to those who dwell in realms of day? For years I wondered what the hell he was getting at. That was back in my skin diving days. Now I know what he's getting at. sexuality is so much of a problem for people because they're so married to it, which is fine. I'm married to it too, in a different kind of way, because I'm celibate now. But it doesn't mean it goes away. It's part of our constitution. But inevitably the arguments arise as, why do you have to do this? Why do you have to control sexuality? Well, you know, the consequences are a fair indication of why. If you don't, the consequences of not doing so. But that isn't enough. It has to do with relinquishing fear of death, attachment to life, obsession with life, obsession with feeling alive. Monk saw this movie last week about a bunch of old folks living in a hotel in India. Now, it was one of the most colorful, amusing, charming, beautifully scripted movies I've seen in years. But what it boiled down to, the premise that was being presented, was that copulation after year 70 is just what you need to abolish the fear of death. And frankly, I don't buy it. I think it's garbage. But there we are. Didn't stop it from being a wonderful movie. Intoxication. You know, you're never going to get away from intoxication. The fact that you have a bloodstream, that you are alive, means you're intoxicated. And that's just the way things are. However, deliberate self-intoxication is evasiveness. You don't want to do that in any way. And there are so many ways to do it. It doesn't involve chemicals necessarily. It doesn't involve liquor necessarily. It involves habit patterns, things that make you feel good, food, things like that. Okay, there are so many ways in which we intoxicate ourselves to try and crank up a feeling of feeling good. It doesn't pay. Let it go. Then maybe the feeling bad in the absence of those things will diminish. Shakespeare wrote a beautiful little sonnet one time about sex. He was always writing about sex. He said that if you can, I can't do more than paraphrase the last couple of lines of it. But if you're going to avoid the hell of growing old in worthless self-indulgence, then you have to let go of the heaven that romance seems to offer. You ain't going to get rid of the one without giving up the other. It's a very hard lesson, because pleasure seems such a quick fix. But there you are. Anger. People ask about anger. How do I let go of my anger? What do I do about my anger? Well, everybody's got anger. And Buddhist psychology, for what it's worth, says that anger is the fundamental characteristic of this particular world we live in, the human world. You know what they talk about, the six worlds? You know, devas and hell and animals and humans and hungry ghosts and asuras, all on that big wheel that goes round and round and round. The human realm is supposed to be characterized by anger. At least this is the traditional teaching in Buddhism. And of course we're human, so there we are. This, however, is an insufficient explanation to somebody who has just hit his brother over the head and wants to know why. Now what do I do about it? Knowing, of course, that anger makes a person hopelessly untrustworthy and it feels so bloody bad on the inside. for most people most of the time. Well, what do we do with it? If you meditate, it won't go away. But it will become softer and familiar, and it will become your friend. As humanity itself will become your friend, you'll find that it was always your friend. That anger was originally the way you protected yourself against others who were angry. And heaven knows we need that protection. We used to tell Red Master Jiu that pacifism was the right way to go. And she would say, I stood on a bridge in London and a German in a plane sprayed bullets at me. And a man pulled me down behind the parapet of the bridge and I lived. I didn't like the blitz, she said, and war against Hitler was necessary. And a lot of people died, but we got rid of Hitler. End of commentary. Don't imagine that Buddhism and pacifism go together. Do not kill. Doesn't mean that you must be a pacifist. Anger has a place in the world, has a place in you. I can't tell you what it is. It's such a moving target. But if you do the training, you'll find out for yourself. Like Kazan said in the piece that I read, you need to find it out for yourself. I need to find it out for myself. Having somebody else tell you about it doesn't do the job. Although we can talk about it in a situation like this. You can talk about it in Sanzen, and these things are helpful. It's good. Conversation's good stuff. You know? It helps people recognize each other's humanity, to see in the other person's face the lines that we have in our own. Recognizing another person's pain is a way of confessing our own. At least it helps in that direction for most people. I think I said pretty much all I wanted to say. Yeah, that'll do. But change is a good thing. Being stuck is part of change. Everybody feels stuck at various times on the path. You feel like you're not getting anywhere. Like you've tried it all and it doesn't work. I can remember Rinpoche Master Chushin telling a story one time. He's dead now. This was years and years and years and years ago, before he ever became a senior monk. He was living here. He was one of the English monks who came over in 77 or 78 or whenever it was. He said, I was hitting, you know, it was evening, he said, winter evening. It was around 7 o'clock or whatever. It was time to go to the hall for meditation. And he thought, you know, it doesn't do any bloody good. I've been doing it for however long. I never get anywhere. But he went anywhere, anyway. And that evening he woke up. It wasn't a huge breakthrough or anything, but it was enough. Enough to help him remember this, remember what had happened. You just keep going. When you've forgotten about waking up, you stand half a chance. When you just do the best you can instead of setting up ideals, you got half a chance. When you're willing to let go of what feels good, for no reason you can put your finger on, but you just feel, well, this is, the book says the right thing to do. Maybe I should give it a try. Then you stand half a chance. Half a chance is only half a chance. But when you get a half a chance every day, then it starts to be a pretty good chance. Anyway, that'll have to do. Thanks very much.